This is David Rutledge. Welcome to the Earshot podcast. Great to have your company. And in this program, we're going back to pre-war Australia, when we had a visit from popular science fiction writer H.G. Wells from the spring of 1938 into the summer of 1939. H.G. Wells was something of a rock star at the time, and he was invited to give a series of talks about science, as well as some radio broadcasts. And two of those broadcasts have survived on crackly acetate tape in the ABC archives. Well, they're the starting point for today's program, as Jennifer Bowen traces the writer's journey across Australia and the reception that he received. It didn't all go according to plan.
Identification. This tape is a Radio Archives working copy. Cut one is H.G. Wells and is XAR5.
I have been asked to give a talk on the Australian air. It has occurred to me that you might be interested in a few things I have learnt about one particular sort of booklet. This is fiction about the future. Almost my first published book was The Time Machine, which went millions of years ahead.
What was most interesting, I think, are two talks he gave on Australian radio, one called Fiction About the Future and the other called Utopias. These are really his last reflections on the two forms of fiction with which he'd been most closely associated. And for a long time, because they were not published outside Australia, they were not well known. He reflects in a rather self-deprecating way about this whole business of foretelling the future.
I doubt whether one can call anything of this sort literature, in the sense that it aims to be something perfect and enduring. Maybe no literature is perfect and enduring, but there is something specially and incurably topical about all these prophetic books. The more you go ahead, the more you seem to get entangled with the burning questions of your own time.
He said quite percipiently, I think, that the problem with history was what to do with all the young men who don't know what to do with their lives.
The nickname that he had at the time as a writer was the man who invented the future.
He certainly wasn't conventional. He anticipated that future societies would be sexually egalitarian and much more sexually libertine. And of course he's right about that.
He very strongly felt Australia should become a republic, and I think he felt it probably wouldn't be that far away.
I've no doubt if he were to come back today, he would be just as despairing and probably angry about the state of the world as he was in his own time. He called his concern human ecology.
H.G. Wells was born in 1866. He was famous from the 1890s for his fiction. He was 72 when he arrived in Australia, and the ABC had never paid so much to a visiting speaker, £50 a talk.
In the 1930s, it's probably fair to say that he's the most famous intellectual in the English-speaking world.
Andrew Milner of Monash University.
The film of Things to Come is made in 1936, and it's a hugely successful film. Orson Welles' radio adaptation of The War of the Worlds is 1938. He's a very, very outspoken and very well-known figure. There is probably no writer who is as well-known at the time.
He was known as an author of popular fiction, but it was really after the First World War that he emerged as one of the two great public intellectuals of his time in the English-speaking world. The other was Bernard Shaw. And the book that really gave him that prominence was his Outline of History, his History of the World, which he published immediately after the First World War in 1920.
Patrick Parander of Reading University in Britain.
And one of the curious things about his Outline of History, it begins with a long account of the prehistory of the human species, which you would not have found in earlier history books, And it ends with a rather shorter, obviously, but an account of the next stage in history.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News. At 20 minutes before 8 Central Time, Professor Farrell of the Mount Jennings Observatory, Chicago, Illinois, reports observing several explosions of incandescent gas occurring at regular intervals on the planet Mars. The spectroscope indicates the gas to be hydrogen and moving toward the Earth with enormous velocity. We now return you to the music of Ramon Raquello, playing for you in the Meridian Room of the Park Plaza Hotel, situated in downtown New York.
The War of the Worlds is a fascinating novel. I mean, it's such a cliche now, the idea of alien invasion. But it's the first Martian invasion in fiction. And lots of people have played with the idea since. And it's not as fanciful at the time when Wells thinks about it, because we didn't know very much about Mars. We didn't know whether or not there was intelligent life on Mars. And how Wells represents it as a dying planet, which is running out of resources, a species driven to migrate by adverse circumstances. Now, this is, again, has become a science fiction cliche, but it's actually a very smart idea as to why they would invade. And how they invade is, well, he quite specifically likens it to the British invasion of Tasmania. It's a much more subversive novel, in a way, than it at first looks. In the 1890s, we're talking about the heyday, the absolute high point of the British Empire under Queen Victoria. And to stand it on its head in that way is very striking.
Suppose, which is quite within the range of biological possibility, that a means were discovered for producing children, and feminine children only, without actual fathers. Most doctors and biologists now will tell you that that is at least a conceivable thing. Suppose you were a psychologist enough to speculate how a girl would grow up to womanhood in a manless world, a girl for whom the marriage market did not exist. What sort of emotional releases would she discover? How would women tackle the complicated mechanisms of life? What modifications of political life would they make? Would they care less for beauty than they do now, or more, and so on?
H.G. Wells arrived in Australia in December 1938. He stepped ashore at Perth and travelled by plane, car and train eastwards for the following 5 weeks.
Well, he was invited to Australia to give an address to the 24th ANZUS meeting.
Ros Haynes from the University of New South Wales.
ANZUS, of course, stands for the Australian and New Zealand Association for the Advancement of Science, but quite new in January 1939 was the education section. And who better to invite to address this section than H.G. Wells, because the actual topic of that ANZUS meeting was the place of science in world affairs.
He'd been to Russia 3 times, he'd been to North America, the United States, on many occasions, so he was pretty well-travelled, but he'd never been to the Southern Hemisphere. He was a world-famous writer, he had a message for the whole world, and I think he probably jumped at the opportunity.
I think he suddenly thought Australia is becoming a power in the Pacific. Maybe Australians could stop being vassals of Britain, as he had thought of them, and just colonialists, and they could take a place in world affairs. So he was looking at Australia as a place where he might get an audience who would actually enact his ideas.
Things to come predicted the outbreak of renewed warfare in Europe in January 1940. I mean, there was a strong sense that this man really got the future right. Now, of course, he, like all science fiction writers, he gets some of it right and some of it wrong, but he was seen as a kind of secular prophet.
In our tradition, there are two different kinds of prophet, you know. There's the Hebrew idea of the moral teacher, the preacher, the figure who tells us that you must transform your lives, otherwise dreadful things will happen to you. There's also the Greek idea, like a prophetess such as Cassandra, the Delphic oracle, which tells you what the future is going to be, and there's nothing you can do about it. And the thing about Wells is that he is both those different kinds of prophet.
Professor Pearson?
Yes, Mr. Ross?
Can you tell us the meaning of that scraping noise inside the thing?
Possibly the unequal cooling of its surface. The metal casing is definitely extraterrestrial.
End of the thing is beginning to flake off. The top is beginning to rotate like a screw, and the thing must be hollow.
For most Australians, he had just a reputation as a writer of science fiction. So people had read his novels like The Invisible Man, The Time Machine, The War of the Worlds, The History of Mr. Polly, Kipps, many of those other novels. And that was fine. People were really interested in what he had to say. So he was greeted as a writer of science fiction.
Susanna Fullerton has made a study of literary visitors to Australia.
However, for quite some time, H.G. Wells had been getting involved on other topics back in Britain. Topics such as warning people that another world war might well happen, speaking out against censorship, he was pro-abortion. He picked up on a lot of really quite controversial topics in Britain, and when he came to Australia, he wanted to talk to Australians about those things as well. So while his visit began fairly peacefully, it deteriorated, I think one could say, as time went on, and became more and more controversial.
He came to Australia immediately after the Munich crisis, when a lot of people, Wells included, of course, thought that the British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain had sold out in doing a deal with Hitler, agreeing to overlook, as it were, the invasion of Czechoslovakia. Everybody saw that a world war was coming. Now, Wells had been campaigning for a more peaceful world since the First World War. He coined that phrase, the start of the First World War, the war that will end war. He was looking at how we could get beyond this warlike state.
I think some of the fans and the fellow writers were perhaps a little bit puzzled that he was spending as much of his time as he did on politics and other issues. I think they just wished he would get on with writing more of the wonderful books that they loved. Everywhere he went, there were journalists wanting his opinion about different things.
By the time he came to Australia, he was very accustomed to dealing with the press. He loved being the centre of attention. He was also an accomplished performer on the radio, but of course you have to remember that everything on radio in those days was scripted, so you won't hear the spontaneous Wells in his radio broadcasts. I don't know. I think sometimes the interviewers in Australia may have found him a bit tetchy.
In particular, he spoke out against the totalitarian regimes of the time, Hitler and Mussolini, and was reprimanded hugely for doing so, because at this stage, Australia was very much following the Chamberlain line of appeasement. Please don't say anything nasty about these people. And Wells just said, that's ridiculous. They're fascist bullies, and we can't tolerate this. And the German ambassador to Australia got on the line to the Prime Minister, Joseph Lyons, and he reprimanded Wells, and there was even talk of censoring Wells's public announcements and so on.
Some people spoke out to support the Prime Minister. Mary Gilmore, the writer, was one of those. She was horrified that this visiting Englishman had insulted world leaders in that way and had contradicted the Prime Minister, Joe Lyons. But many people took HG's part. A real battle raged in the press. And of course, within a year, Australia was at war with Germany, and Australians were, of course, insulting Hitler on a very regular basis, and that was regarded as a very patriotic thing to do.
The other day, I gave a talk on fiction about the future. Today, I'm going to say something about a type of work, utopian fiction, often associated with anticipatory tales. The utopian story imagines a better and a happier world and makes no pretense whatever to reality. For 24 centuries, at least, men have been telling utopian stories. And they're all stories arising out of discontent and escaping towards dreamland. They all express a certain appetite for life. If only. If only. That is the utopian keynote.
H.G. Wells believed that if you could change the education of the young, you could actually transform the world. He blamed the education system of his time, and particularly the teaching of history. He made a rather controversial intervention in Australia called the Poison of History. He thought that history teaching was us against them. It was all concerned with establishing a sectional cultural identity rather than seeing the problems of the human species as a whole.
The title of his paper was actually a provocative paper on the poison called history. People who came along, they were mostly, of course, historians. What he was really saying was that all the history you teach is absolutely ridiculous. If you're going to learn about the past, it should be a universal past without national heroes or national villains. Most of the points that he made were virtually ignored. And at the end, William Morris Hughes stood up and said, well, God save the king, which was absolutely irrelevant. They felt Wells was painting a very bleak future. But that was really because he was saying, if you don't change your views, if you don't get over this aggressive nationalism, then it could be the end of Homo sapiens. He really believed that.
I'd like to see the wonders they'll see.
Don't be too sure of progress.
Oh, listen to the incurable pessimist.
What's to stop progress nowadays?
War.
Firstly, there isn't going to be a war, and secondly, war doesn't stop progress. It stimulates progress.
Yes, war can be a highly stimulating thing, but you can overdo a stimulant.
Oh, well, after all, aren't we exaggerating the horrors of war? Don't we rather overdo that song? After all, you know, the last war wasn't as bad as some people make out. We didn't worry. Something great seemed to have got hold of us.
Something greater still may get hold of us next time. If we don't end war, war will end us.
Well, what can you do?
Yeah. What can we do?
Wells's views are quite clear. He was opposed to nationalism, and he wanted to see the abolition of nation states. He wanted to see world government, a world state. He felt this was the only way eventually we would overcome war. Now, in fact, Wells's criticisms of history teaching, and indeed, actually, they can be extended to literature teaching as well. The way we taught, and it's less true now, but the way we used to teach history was entirely as the history of your nation. Now, in fact, in Australia, it's complicated because it's the history of the British nation, and there is a counter-argument, which is the history of the Australian nation, and there's a tension between the two, but it's not really world history at all. Wells was deeply critical about this, and at one level, I'd be inclined to echo his criticisms. I think we've moved slightly away from this today. But if you want to educate generations to be good nationalists, willing to volunteer to get themselves killed, killing foreigners, then a good way to do this is to tell the story, the historical story, including the history of literature, as if there was only your nation. And Wells thought this was extremely dangerous and damaging.
This is Newark, New Jersey. This is Newark, New Jersey. Warning, poisonous black smoke pouring in from Jersey marshes. Urge population to move into open spaces. Automobiles use Route 7, 23, 24. Avoid congested areas.
I came here to learn what I could from the Australian and the New Zealand Association for the Advancement of Science, which has just been meeting at Canberra. All the men and women in that association, I warn you, are utopians. And they believe their utopia is real. They believe that this world of ours can only be put in order and kept in order by the perpetual refreshment of scientific thought. They believe as firmly as any human beings have ever believed that swords can be beaten into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks, that nation need not lift up its hand against nation, nor should they learn war anymore. But they do not prophesy that that will certainly happen. They say, if only you would.
The main criticism of his utopian writings. How are you going to get people to think like you? And there was one very pertinent thing that he describes in his autobiography. where he and Joseph Conrad, the novelist, are sitting on a beach and talking about their ideals. And Conrad says to him, "You know, Wells, the difference between you and me is that you love humanity and hate people, whereas I love people and hate humanity." And I think that's a very, very pertinent expression, because so often social reformers do hate individual people because they get in the way of the reforms. They get in the way of these brilliant ideas that the reformers have had, and therefore we have to get rid of them somehow. Wells felt that if you simply had the right education, they wouldn't be there. They would come along with his plans because they were, to him, so self-evident.
You know, he'd published a book in 1938 that he called World Brain, in which he had advocated the need for a world encyclopedia, a single source of scientifically based knowledge which would be available to everybody. This has often been seen as a precursor of the internet, maybe Wikipedia as we know it today.
Wells was scientifically trained. He studied at what is now part of Imperial College London. So he comes out of a scientific background, like his great French rival Jules Verne. And the combination in Wells of science and also socialism, he's a Fabian, these are both, at the time, very much future-oriented discourses, and they blend in Wells's own preoccupations very, very interestingly. So there is a strong stress on what is possible, but there are limits to the possible, too. That's the debt to Darwin. He is a Darwinian. He doesn't believe in the crude version of the survival of the fittest, but what he does believe is that society is evolving, and it evolves in ways that have to be understood in evolutionist terms. And the more you understand, the more you're able to make rational choices about what is and what isn't possible.
Knowledge is power. That was the dominant thought of Bacon's Atlantis, the greatest of all the scientific utopias. It confessed that man is still an ignorant creature who has everything to learn. It embodies a new conception in human life, the conception of continual organized research. All the other utopias present islands, communities, and worlds of happy and exemplary completion and self-satisfaction. But the utopia of Francis Bacon is a world of seekers after knowledge, a world growing perpetually in knowledge and wisdom, and incidentally growing in power.
When H.G. Wells went to Canberra to attend the scientific conference that he'd been invited to speak at, the temperatures were absolutely incredible. They were in the high 40s. In fact, one of the Canberra hotels, the kitchen staff all refused to cook because the temperature in the kitchen reached 49 degrees. H.G. was invited to stay at Government House. And of course, as a fairly correct Englishman, he had his long-sleeved shirt, his thick woolen trousers, his waistcoat, his tie, his jacket, his hat, and he absolutely boiled. Now, at the time that he was in Canberra was also the time of the January 1939 bushfires, and H.G. was taken out by the Governor-General to inspect the fires, to have a look at the teams of firefighters and how they were managing to control the blaze, and he was really fascinated by the sight of this amazing bushfire. And later on, when he got back to England, he wrote a book about his time in Australia. And one of the chapters in that book is about the Canberra bushfires. And it's a very clear, vivid description of what a great bushfire is like. The way in which the sparks are blown and it jumps from one place to another and so quickly is out of control and can surround the firefighters. He writes of it very vividly indeed.
If you look at the full title of the book that he published, giving some of his speeches and articles he wrote when he was in Australia, was called Travels of a Republican Radical in Search of Hot Water. Now, even for Wells, that's a pretty fighting title. And it seems to me that, you know, people are supposed to mellow as they get older. Here was Wells, he was in his early 70s. He didn't mellow, quite the reverse. He's actually fiercer, I think, in Australia than he'd been before. His later overseas visit in late 1940 was when he went to the United States. The people who engaged him for a lecture tour told him, well, we want you to give a number of public lectures, but we don't want you to be quite as controversial as you were in Australia.
H.G. Wells was guest of honour at the inaugural dinner for Melbourne Penn in January 1939. Penn, the Association for Writers' Freedom of Expression. One of the menus from the dinner was kept as a souvenir, signed by everybody present. Wells, of course, and Vance Palmer, Louis Essen, Jean Campbell, Myra Morris. It's at the National Library in Canberra.
Many people are surprised to learn that H.G. Wells ever came to Australia, and they don't know why he was here, they don't know what date he was here, or what he did while he was in the country. It's interesting, if you go for a walk around Sydney Harbour at Circular Quay, they have what's called the Sydney Writers' Walk, where some big brass plaques are set into the pavement, recording the visits of Australian writers to Sydney, but also the visits of people who have come from much further afield. So you'll find a plaque for Charles Darwin, for Anthony Trollope, Joseph Conrad, D.H. Lawrence, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, giving some idea of when they came and what they thought of Sydney Harbour. But there is no plaque for H.G. Wells in that writer's walk.
The exciting thing about Wells was the enthusiasm with which he embraced his ideas and the fact that he really didn't care whether people liked them or not. He didn't pussyfoot about the expression of them, and that was why he got into so much hot water. His modus operandi was to try and provoke people to think in different ways, to jerk them out of their reactionary thinking, as he himself had been jerked out of his class, his narrow-minded parents and teachers, and suddenly the world made sense.
You might think there was something malicious about the future, as though it didn't like to be prophesied about and dodged well. I should class all this futuristic stuff as journalism. If posterity reads it at all, it will probably be to marvel at our want of knowledge, imagination, and hope.
Writer H.G. Wells recorded in Adelaide in December 1938 during his trip to Australia for the 1939 Australia and New Zealand Science Association Conference. And there you also heard Professor Andrew Milner, Associate Professor Roslyn Haynes, Professor Patrick Parender, and writer Susanna Fullerton. Now, thanks to them, and full details of their books can be found on the website, where you can also download this program, indeed all of our programs, for listening whenever and wherever you like. abc.net.au/rn. Look for Earshot on the program menu. And many thanks as well to ABC Radio Archives. Today's feature was produced by Jennifer Bowen with sound engineer Richard Gervin. And you've been listening to RN's Earshot podcast. I'm David Rutledge. Thanks for your company. Bye for now.
If you assumed that you'd be near a radio last Sunday at 3 and weren't, you missed this.
We generate just over 2 kilograms of waste per person per day.
Corruption in China may be simply a tax on doing business.
I guess what I would probably call a date in your culture, you might call a wedding.
You can still catch last week's episode of Assumptions with me, Susan Carland. Look for us at the RN homepage.